mechanical way, reacting to external demands or instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Since you guys are here, I just couldn't resist having you help me with the beginning of the podcast. And this is going to be episode 41, which I think I'll call On the Human Scale, which is something Takis Fotopoulos talks about in the interview, which is going to be coming up. But you both listened to a few clips from last week's interview and from what's coming up, and I was wanting to kind of talk about that and just also say that it was great having you guys here for the Transitional Alchemy event last night and just having you as guests here. So,
Guys. Yeah, it was excellent. Really good. Yeah. Really good night.
Yeah. So, KMO, you had listened most closely to the clips and you had a couple of things you wrote down. You want to talk about those?
Well, sure. Let me first just ask you to tell me what libertarian socialism is, because at face value, that seems to be a contradiction in terms.
Right. Well, and I think a lot of American listeners would definitely see that those two terms being contradictory. The way I look at it is the kind of society that you need to be the most free would be the kind of society where there's the most collective participation in decision-making and on an economic level. So a libertarian socialist is basically an anti-statist socialist looking to create communities based on mutual aid and cooperation, but without centralized state control directing that.
So, yeah, socialism in the absence of centralized state control seems to... That's probably what sets off my, my
right.
cognitive dissonance detector.
Right, right. But the thing to remember about, and you know, I should point out that I was recently on Frank Aragona's podcast, The Agro Innovations.
Name dropper.
Because we talked about just this for about an hour. Yeah, the history of socialism includes both currents, but even Marx doesn't envision a socialist society ultimately relying on state centralized control. You know, there's a whole idea of the state withering away after you get a transitional period of the dictatorship of the proletariat. So the difference between like a libertarian socialist or an anarchist and a Marxist is whether or not that transitional part is necessary and how quickly you can move to true community control and decentralized power on an economic and a political level. And that's what a libertarian socialist is. And for the majority, at least from the anarchist perspective or the socialist perspective, we want to claim that word libertarian.
Mm-hmm. Funny word, that libertarian, because is it talking about liberation or liberty?
Well, I think both. I mean, liberation is the transition from slavery into liberty, isn't it?
Right, it is. And I think that in the U.S., the folks who sort of gravitate to this libertarian meme complex are people who are quite friendly to, large concentrations of private wealth and power, and they look to preserve the liberty of the privileged elites and would see any sort of mucking about with redistribution of wealth or anything like that that might liberate the serfs as being contrary to liberty, you know, mm-hmm. and... I'm sure that they would heartily disagree with, you know, my summation of the position, but that's how it looks to me.
Yeah, well, I agree. And I think that's why a lot of people who call themselves libertarian socialists would have a problem with libertarian capitalists, as it's known, or the libertarians as they're known here. But the thing that I find interesting about the libertarian tradition in the United States is that on a whole range of issues, I end up you know, agreeing with most libertarians, you know, mm-hmm. of course, about things like marijuana and gun control and the usefulness of the state. These are things that libertarians of both stripes pretty much agree about. It's just the economic perspective that's very different. I'm just not a market capitalist. Or I am, because I live in this country. But
not by choice.
But I'm not by choice, yeah. What else did you have written down there? Because we had listened to two clips, I think. One was about Takis Fotopoulos' ideas or response to Noam Chomsky as a libertarian socialist. And in fact, he denied that label for Chomsky. And then the other clips were about the human scale of community, bringing production, the economic system down to the human scale, the possibility that the elites would be able to continue to manage through what he calls a multidimensional crisis, in which there are ecological crises and there are economic crises and social disintegration and so on. As that he feels that without a political movement to fight off the current system, that the current system will be able to maintain itself as a crisis through the multidimensional crisis. So what did you think of those clips?
Well, I was just thrown into Alex Jones land, really, that not only could the elites weather a multidimensional crisis, but it might even be to their advantage to engineer one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was struck about his comments about technology, because he was at pains to say that he did not advocate any sort of Luddite utopian primitivism, that he thought that high technology should be pursued and embraced just, you know, more intelligently, and that he thought the natural unit of community survival is a community of 30,000 to 50,000 people, mm-hmm. which is very much in line with the message that James Howard Kunstler is proposing, you know, that mm-hmm. megalopolises are unsustainable, but you do need a decent core of citizenry to make civilization happen in any way that we recognize as, you know, mm-hmm. as worthy of what we can achieve.
Right. How did James Howard Kunstler come to that number of 30 to 50,000?
I don't know that he states that exact range, but he's talking about, you know, small cities, not your isolated small town out in the country, but something that is actually a city and can sustain some level of local industry, mm-hmm. which, you know, a small city is not going to have, or a small town is not going to have factories, whereas mm-hmm. a small to mid-sized city in the U.S., which particularly one that was vital prior to World War II, is going to have some mothballed infrastructure for appropriate scaled industry.
Yeah, that seems logical to me. That seems right. Neil, you and I were discussing Noam Chomsky and the American left before we started recording, and I think you listened to a bit of Takis's talk about Noam Chomsky. Throw out what your thoughts are.
Okay. Politics in the UK has a longer history, because it can be traced back to a time when things were very, very straightforward, which was that you either owned no land, a little bit of land, or a lot of land. And most people in the first category were basically just born into serfdom. And all the political structures of the last, you know, few hundred years emanate out from that. So in the UK, at the present time, there are only three main competing parties: Labour, the Liberal Democrats in the middle, and on the right, the Conservative Party. So to put that, for those who are not familiar with those political structures in the UK, Labour is Democrats, Conservatives is Republican. And in the middle we have this charade, really, of liberal democracy, which is nonsense. If you go back to the 50s and 60s, Labour was Labour. It was for the workers. And the Conservatives were for people who had a certain amount of education and expendable income, which was a minority. From my observations, I see that the various systems that operate at the top level, unseen, have engineered an eradication of the middle classes, which has led to everybody basically playing in the same space now, which is in the middle. Mm-hmm. For me personally, the notion of politics is nonsensical. I just do not think in those terms anymore. it seems to be that the political structure and the political dialogue is set up kind of like a chessboard, as we have used this metaphor this morning when we were discussing this, but for the benefit of the recording, if the chessboard is offered up with a set number of pieces and a set number of squares on the board, it doesn't really matter how many moves you make or what configuration of pieces you have, that board is contained and does not offer a solution. So for me, it's always fascinating. I mean, I probably am more familiar with the works of Sartre, having been turned onto his novel Nausea. Mm-hmm. And then seeing this vast tome of being and nothingness, which just the size of the spine on the bookshelf was impressive enough for me to take it off and skip through this thing. I think this looks really like a life's work, and I'm going to absorb this, which I did. And as I mentioned earlier, I've probably read it 3 times now, and to me it is more so than Chomsky, because I'm not that familiar with his work other than the sketches that are outlined on shows like yours. But for me, Sartre showed that if you don't agree with the constructs you find yourself within, you cannot actually combat that by creating more constructs. So the analysis of the flaws within a certain set of political constructs is not solved, is not ameliorated, and is certainly not eradicated by creating alternative constructs, alternative structures. So there is a missing game here. You know, you cannot do it with what is available. So to some degree, anybody who holds a view within the construct that is in opposition to the mainstream, even though it may be inspirational rhetoric of people like Chomsky, ultimately they are complicit in the perpetuation of that system by defining one of its edges. Mm-hmm. So that is my issue with that, and that is why I do not pour energy into it, because it's very one-dimensional and there's a whole piece missing. There's no real talk of consciousness or the divine or spiritual context. It's just critical analysis of constructs, which is very, very left brain and is only half the story.
Yeah, well, I think that we should get to the interview soon here. But I think that if anything we can get out of this interview or others like it that you're going to hear on Diet Soap, it's maybe you're watching a really good chess game. And if that resonates with you on other levels as well, just seeing the artistry of it,
yeah,
of that side, good.
Yes.
And
agreed, yeah. But to observe a good Kasparov short chess game is sweet and it is good, but you're still playing chess.
And we are. KMO, do you have anything else you want to say? I want to thank you both for coming out here, actually. It was great having you.
Well, hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Closing remarks. I don't talk partisan politics on the C Realm podcast. Mm-hmm. And I do still have an interest in it, and that's one reason why I tune in to Diet Soap every week.
Yeah. Partisan, doesn't that have to do with parties?
You know, when I use the word partisan, I just mean it to be, you've got groups of people who are strongly self-defined and in opposition to another group.
Okay. Well, then, yeah. I definitely talk partisan politics.
You do.
That definition. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're listening, even though you don't do that on your own show. So, let's get to the interview with Takis Fotopoulos. Takis Fotopoulos, you are the political philosopher and economist who founded the Inclusive Democracy Movement. You are noted for your synthesis of classical democracy with libertarian socialism, or anarchism, and you are the editor of the International Journal of Inclusive Democracy. Do you envision these decentralized communities of shared power, these inclusive democracies, to be less technological than our current society? Do you see that there'll be a shift to more handmade, a more small-scale, local production within these kinds of inclusive democracies?
Yeah, actually, this is the idea, that we have to move to new kinds, new methods of production and new technologies that could secure an effective kind of production system within smaller scale production units. What happens today is that, as you know, you have the utter irrationality where in your local supermarket you buy commodities which may have been produced in the next village or the next town or whatever, and they go through the entire distribution network of the supermarket and they may come to you through Hong Kong or whatever. I mean, all this huge waste in terms of transport, in terms of production cost and distribution cost that is created by the huge concentration of economic power would be avoided if you have a decentralized production system where lots of products, especially in the agricultural sector, but also in the manufacturing sector, could be produced at a local, smaller scale. I do not argue in favor of a kind of return to conditions and technologies of Middle Ages or so on, that is not supporting this kind of utopian primitive anarchism. I think that what we have to do is to utilize the present state of knowledge, the present state of advanced knowledge, and create new technologies because the ability is there. It's only the matter of how we use this kind of knowledge and this kind of ability to create new methods of production and new kinds of production which are based at a human scale, which are based, in other words, on smaller scale production than the present one. Of course, there are areas where this will not be possible. You cannot produce electricity, say, in an area of 50,000 people. There are problems that have to be sorted out at the federal or the confederal level. But the basic production unit in the inclusive democracy project we envisage is one based on a local community of 30 up to 50,000 people, because only this sort of scale you can have direct democracy working. You can have, in other words, assemblies taking all the important economic and political decisions, and also you can have the kind of economic democracy and ecological democracy that is compatible with this kind of decentralized society.
Now, you consider yourself to be part of the anti-systemic left, meaning you're against this market system. And you trace your struggle back to May 1968 and beyond, further back. But it strikes me that you might be the right age to have had been profoundly impacted by May of 1968. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, May 68 was, in fact, a kind of impromptu social explosion which was expressing the wishes and the desires of people who have overcome both the kind of capitalism. Actually, I took part in May 68 events in London, and I was aware of the fact that the main trends were what we can call anti-systemic trends, that is, they were against both capitalism and state bureaucratic socialism. And the main demand was to have a new society where people will not be controlled by elites, either political elites or economic elites and so on. And also another trend within May 68 was the anti-consumerist trend, which was expressed very well later on by, by De Boer and the situationists and so on. So it was these two trends which were the main trends of May 68. The point is, however, that later on the demands and the slogans of May 68 were distorted by neoliberals, social liberals and so on, who took over. And the aversion of the students of May 68 against state power was taken as a means to promote the market. In other words, whereas in May 68 we were calling, of course, for the abolition of both the state and the market, they simply monopolized the slogan against the state in order to support their view that for everything the state has to be blamed and therefore we have to give power to the people, and by people they meant power to the market. And this is how the entire neoliberal movement developed.
Do you think that's a commonly held view amongst people who still care about May 1968, that it actually validates the market economy? Do you think people believe that?
Yeah, I'm saying that the supporters of the neoliberal movement simply distorted the slogans and the demands of May 68 for their own purposes. Now, of course, there are people who took part in May 68 who also joined the system later on and used also the same arguments in order to support demands which have nothing to do with May 68.
Is that what happened to Daniel Cohn-Bendit, the Green Party leader?
Daniel Cohn-Bendit, yeah, of course, and many others, Fischer, and that is the Green Movement began as a fundamentalist, as you know, movement, which more or less was libertarian, and were seeing the ecological crisis as a systemic crisis that could not be, in other words, sorted out within the present system. But then it was the Realos who got the upper hand in the Green German movement and later on in the rest of the Green movement. And it was developed as a systemic kind of political party which is supposed through improvements in the present system to sort out the ecological crisis. Of course, the results are well known. Not only the ecological crisis has not been sorted out, instead it's deteriorating every day, but also the Green parties took part in all the criminal wars of the transnational elite all over the place. So they have become supporters of the system. And unfortunately, the same happened also to other movements that began in May 68, the feminist movement, for example. Again, it was the beginning, the libertarian and communist trends within the feminist movement were dominant. And then it was the reformists within the movement, what they called the insiders, who dominated the movement. And it became a kind of movement to improve the position of some elites within women rather than of women themselves. That is, apart from some general changes which happen in society and would have happened anyway, like, for example, the freedom of women to be able to earn their own income, etc. But this was more or less the result not of the feminist movement action, but because of the needs of the capitalist market economy to expand. And that's why they introduced many women to labor and therefore to some sort of economic freedom. But on the other hand, this created many other side effects. However, what we have today is that the elites, the political and economic elites, have been expanded to include also women, to include also black people, etc. But this does not mean that the general position of the black population or women have expanded accordingly or have been improved accordingly.
Right. I can imagine a society without racism being a capitalist market economy, but I can't imagine a society where all women and minorities were free to participate in sharing power. That wouldn't work. The classless society wouldn't work under capitalism, obviously. You wrote an essay about May 68 in which you said that one of the problems in that spontaneous revolution or attempt at revolution was that it had a lack of any kind of political project behind it. There was no strategy or tactics. But it strikes me that there was about 20 years of development of strategy and tactics with socialism or barbarism and the Letterist International and the Situationist International. Do you think that those groups failed to develop an adequate political project or strategy?
No, I don't think that these groups have actually played any effective role in the explosion. They influenced the people who took part in May 68. I was influenced also by Socialismo Barbari. But to say that all this explosion was somehow controlled, or if not controlled, somehow being framed within a particular set of ideas, either social barbarism or the ideas of De Boer or others, I think it's an over-exaggeration. This was not the case. There were, in other words, there were too many currents, political currents and movements fighting each other within May 68. That is, apart from these movements or currents, there were also the old Trotskyists, Maoists, socialists, communists, and so on, other kinds of currents that were, in fact, were trying also to dominate this movement. And in fact, to some extent, May 68, in France particularly, failed because the working class followed these old movements, and also like the CGT, the French syndicalist union, which was controlled by the Communist Party, and students were actually expressing, many of them expressing the ideas you mentioned. But on the other hand, no, you cannot say that there was any organized kind of revolt. There was, in the sense that the majority of people taking part in May 68 had any concrete political program apart from some general ideas and some general demands, or any concrete transitional strategy, or any kind of thinking of how to organize society next day. There were some beautiful demands and ideas expressed in a very nice way by students and others taking part in these events, but all this cannot amount to an organized, relatively well power that could take over the existing power. In other words, don't forget that we were talking about fighting a system which was tremendously organized. I mean, its repression, its ideological repression, and its physical repression. And you cannot overthrow a system like this just by creating some barricades on the roads and creating some mass demonstrations and shout slogans. Obviously, much more is needed than this. And that's why I'm saying that any kind of instantaneous explosion, it's beautiful in the sense that it could create, or it could expand rapidly the level of consciousness of people, but as a precondition, or as a first step, in creating the conditions that would lead to a change in society. You cannot expect out of an insurrection a change in society, and it never happened in history. It was always various kinds of political organizations that were organized that eventually took power. Take the Soviet Revolution and so on. I'm not saying that you need a communist party as highly organized as it was, and hierarchical and so on, because then you're going to create the kind of side effects that were created in actually existing socialism. But I am saying that you have to have the majority of people having the consciousness to function democratically, in other words, to function in a way through the direct democracy assemblies, to function in a way to take political and economic decisions, and you have to have the majority of people who think this way. And the only way the majority of people could start thinking this way is, according to our view, is by creating such institutions where people have started working, functioning within such institutions, and therefore this is the only way their level of consciousness would be the appropriate for these institutions to function effectively. Otherwise, if you try to impose such institutions from above through a revolution and then a political elite which takes power, then you are going to have the kind of totalitarian or semi-totalitarian regimes that we saw. The only way I think that you can avoid this is if you create a high level of consciousness, which can only be created high level of democratic consciousness, I mean, which can only be created if we start developing new institutions within which this level of consciousness, that is through the interplay of theory and practice, to put it this way, within the functioning of these institutions and the people being involved, actually involved in running these institutions, only then they could develop this level of democratic consciousness, not by propaganda, not by shouting slogans or by distributing leaflets. It's the actual interplay of theory and practice that could create this sort of consciousness and therefore the new society.
Whenever you are tired of your lot and you're craving for the things you haven't got, whenever you feel claustrophobic in your little box and you gaze down at the water where it's clashing with the rocks, whenever you become fed up with what the fates are dealing, just remember that the sky is not a ceiling. Whenever you are sick of earthly things and you feel like shedding all your limbs and growing feathered wings, whenever you are standing and you wish that you could fly, when you would give up supper for a small piece of the pie, when your insides feel like breaking out and your outsides feel like peeling, just remember that the sky is not a ceiling. Whenever you are climbing up a tree and the sun at the horizon is as far as you can see, whenever you grow weary at the prospect of old age and you think of Charles Ives and his leopard in the cage, when your body takes the bait and your mind starts in a reeling, just remember that the sky is not a ceiling. Whenever you are tired of the past and you can't make it to the future, but you watch the simulcast, whenever you are weary of this godforsaken place and you want to take a rocket and go into outer space, when you feel like you are lost at sea and drowning in the feeling, just remember that the sky is not a ceiling. The sky is not a ceiling.
Now, you're not talking about creating communes that are outside of the everyday society.
No, not just communes, because the problem with communes is that most of them, anyway, historically, have been created outside society. They are not part of society. Even urban communes, they are isolated, usually experiments run by a few people, and therefore you cannot create direct democratic institutions by communes. That is, okay, you may have communes working perfectly with such democratic rules as against their own running of affairs, but the question is how you could involve people at a significant social scale in such institutions. Otherwise, you simply raise the level of consciousness of people taking part in these experiments. But this is not the problem. The problem is how you can involve as many people as possible in the running of such institutions. And that's why one idea that was suggested also by Mare Buchan, and I also agree, is for taking part in local elections and then introducing the various institutions of local democracy through the decisions, of course, of the neighborhood assemblies, etc. Otherwise, I cannot see any other way for this sort of society and economy to start at a significant social scale.
So the way I could go about it in my life is I could join, say, a neighborhood association, and with people of like minds, come up with some institutions that serve my little neighborhood, but do it in a way that's has run inclusively and democratically.
Yeah, but these neighborhood associations actually could not involve the majority of people which is needed in an area. That is, you can involve certain people who are interested and who are more conscious to take part in such institutions. But on the other hand, neighborhood associations are just pressure groups. That is, you don't have any real power. You try to press for changes or to introduce small changes, but the real power, of course, belongs to the political and economic elite. So the only thing that the only role that such bodies can play is, in effect, some kind of pressure group. But this is not what we're talking about. For people to be actually interested in taking part in democratic institutions, they have to feel that they have power, otherwise they're not interested. That is, even if you call tomorrow direct democracy assembly in your area, then very few people would attend because they would know that it would be just a discussion club.
Right. No, I was thinking there's a community center nearby that might be run by an actual county neighborhood association that has some funding from the county, and you can join that and get involved in that, and you might be able to get enough people together to run some, I don't know, maybe classes or community garden or something that, but run it in a way that was inclusive and democratic. But I need to be maybe a little bit more reach a little bit beyond my grasp here and would someone like myself be better off running for city government or for city council, or where would you start?
Yeah, you may start even without taking over local power, which is perhaps the last stage of this process. You may start with various kind of experiments like the one you mentioned, or you may try the various LED schemes or the local currency schemes and so on, which could involve people who would have interest in taking part in such activities because they suffer. The lack of money among unemployed people created the LED schemes, and similarly local currencies have been created exactly because of the fact that people realize gradually that they do not control their own lives unless they control them within the local level and have some local means of power. So this can be done, but all these experiments, as I said at the beginning, unless they become part of a political project which would aim at the creation of local centers of political and economic power, unless, in other words, they are part of a political project, I think they would be marginalized or sometimes even used by the system. I know in Britain, for example, the Labour government of Blair used effectively the LED schemes and similar schemes in order to reduce social provision. In other words, he relied on provision of services, of social services, because that's what these experiments were doing, of social services on a voluntary basis in order to be able to save money from the actual social services run by the state and therefore reduce the tax rates for the rich and so on. In other words, this has happened. That is, the states, the elites, are using such voluntary experiments for their own purposes, unless such experiments, as I said before, are part of a political program and a political project which aim at the dissolution of the present political and economic institutions, starting at the local level, creating perhaps local institutions like the one you said, but being always part of a new political project and a new political movement, which aims at taking over power at the local level through taking part in elections later on when they feel they, in local elections I mean, when they feel they could take over power at the local level. This is the only way I can see such experiments being in a position to really challenge the present system.
Do you think that the current multidimensional crisis is going to move people in that direction, or do you think that it's creating a situation where that's more likely?
Yeah, I think that As long as people realize that the present multidimensional crisis become deeper and worse all the time, and at the same time see that they pay the price for this, there are two possibilities. If a significant amount of people, that is a significant number of people, begin thinking that, and this is where various currents, etc., like the ones we're discussing, could play a role. If they begin thinking that it's only outside the system that we can sort out these problems, then we are going to move towards this direction, that is the direction of creating and expanding local centers of political and economic power controlled by people themselves. On the other hand, however, there is also the dark scenario, that is that some people may, of course, influenced by the brainwashing of mass media, etc., may start blaming immigrants or various minorities and so on as the cause of their troubles, and also being pushed into kind of semi-totalitarian solutions. And actually the present war against the so-called terrorism and so on, the same in her mind, that is to create semi-totalitarian conditions, as they have been created in Europe and the United States or so on at the moment. It's not just that the elites control the mass media as they used to, it's also that now they control everything from the internet up to London, for example. If you go out of your place and go to the supermarket, you're going to be filmed by dozens of cameras and so on. So you have a situation where a semi-totalitarian society is gradually being created. And there is the danger that if people do not turn to alternative ways of thinking and alternative ways of organizing their life, they may simply adjust to the present semi-totalitarian society that is being created.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there are some people who listen to my podcast who are concerned that we may have reached a tipping point as far as the environment goes and as far as energy goes. You know, the people are concerned about peak oil, and that we're due for a Malthusian correction. Do you think that that is a real danger? Is that we're just going?
Yeah,
to...
I don't think that there could be a terminal so-called crisis. I don't think that the system would implode because of the rapid deterioration of any part of the multidimensional crisis, and particularly the ecological crisis. I think that for the system to collapse, it has to collapse by a combination of objective and subjective factors. In other words, there has to be the level of consciousness that would overthrow the system by the majority of the population, rather than waiting for any kind of objective conditions to be created that would do so. That is, the elites would always find ways to deal with the economic crisis or the ecological crisis and so on, to a certain extent, but they would always find ways. The point is not this. The point is who pays, of course, for the ecological or the economic crisis to be sorted out by the elites. Obviously, they're not the elites and the supporters that would pay the price. It would be usually the lower social groups that would pay the price of sorting out the crisis by the elites themselves. So we should not expect that the deterioration of the present crisis will lead somehow automatically to a new society, unless, in other words, a new mass political movement which is very conscious of what is needed to change society, what is the cause of the present crisis, and what is needed to change society in a different direction is created, then I'm pessimistic. I think that the elite would introduce various measures to deal with the crisis, and people more or less would adjust, that is the majority of people more or less would adjust to the semi-totalitarian solutions. Of course, there are contradictions. For example, they try now to deal with ecological crisis by abolishing some of the consumer privileges, like, for example, traveling by car or not abolishing but restricting them, or traveling by plane and so on. That's why they discuss now introducing taxes on traveling by plane or congestion charges in using your car and so on. Now, all these measures simply mean that the massive use of cars or the massive use of holiday flights and so on would become a luxury commodity as it used to be 20 or 30 years ago. It would not be anymore a kind of commodity enjoyed by every consumer. And the contradiction is, of course, that you try to persuade people that by having more growth, that by expanding, they would participate in the consumer society. And on the other hand, in order to deal with the ecological crisis, in particular, you introduce various measures that would restrict the possibility of expanding the consumer culture. This is a contradiction, but I don't think that any kind of such contradiction by itself would bring down the system.
I was actually saying, when I wrote to you, I asked if you thought that there's a danger that the current system is creating a terminal crisis, and I didn't mean just for the system. I actually meant for the species. Do you feel that we are in danger of being destroyed by the market economy as a species?
I don't think so. I think that even if you take the most pessimistic projections of scientists on the possible effects of the ecological crisis, if you're talking about this, if you're talking about, of course, about a nuclear crisis, etc., that's a different story. But as regards the ecological crisis, I don't think this is the problem. The problem is that some people, particularly in the peripheral countries, the so-called South or Third World, etc., would particularly suffer the effects of the ecological crisis. There you may have significant loss of life, and people would have to move en masse from areas that would be flooded or would become deserts, etc. But I don't think that we can talk about any danger to the species itself. There may be species, of course, among the animal world that would and already been abolished, but not the human species as such. I think that the present system of concentration of power could work also in this direction, that the elites, the privileged social groups in general, would find ways to minimize the effects of the ecological crisis on them. It's only the lower social groups that would pay the price, as it already happened. That is, you don't see any significant floods, etc., and natural disasters among people living in luxury suburbs or in rich areas and so on. You see them always in rich areas and poor areas and deserted areas where no social systems of infrastructure and so on.
So, Takis Fotopoulos, it was great talking to you, and thanks for being on the Diet Soap podcast.
Okay, thank you very much for giving me the chance to take part.
Well, that wraps up the 41st episode of Diet Soap. This episode is going out on Friday, January 21st, 2010, and I want to thank Takis Fotopoulos for taking part in this podcast. And I would encourage anyone who has been listening to this episode in the car, during their commute, or maybe in some other distracting environment, to consider taking the time to sit down with Takis with one of the last two episodes of Diet Soap or both, and give him a concentrated listen. The ideas of Mr. Fotopoulos strike me as vital. It was also great fun to meet KMO and Neil Kramer in the flesh, and to take part in their transitional alchemy couch surfing tour. The event at the Lucky Lab was a terrific success. I met several interesting and enlivening people, including a couple of members of Jason Horsley's group, Sweta. The music you heard at the beginning of the podcast was Brian Eno's ambient music. After that was Chris Isto-White's song, The Sky Is Not a Ceiling, which was also featured on episode 30. That episode featured an interview with KMO wherein we discussed the notion of a new logic, or an anti-capitalist logic, and Frank Loderman's ideas. Right now, you're listening to the music of Trevor O's East Forest, and the track is called York City. So with all of that out of the way, once again, all that's left for this week is Miriam's Titanic Factoid.
So today I have here with me to help me with the Titanic Factoid, Neil Kramer and KMO. So this will be lots of fun. I think that we're going to talk about some Titanic conspiracy theories, which I'm sure no one's ever heard of before. So do you have any thoughts on that, KMO?
Well, I've heard this crazy rumor that the Titanic was swapped for its sister ship, the Olympic, in an insurance scam. I'm wondering if there's any corroborating evidence for this.
Well, Neil?
Well, we were just looking at this on the web, and we found out that whilst making preparations for the blockbuster movie Titanic, James Cameron paid a number of visits to the wreck. And on one of those visits, a small robot submarine equipped with cameras and powerful lights was sent into the interior of the sunken wreck. And it visited one of the staterooms, which showed that this Empire-style sitting room to be in, you know, pretty good condition. And what was noted by one researcher here on TitanicConspiracy.com, for those of you who are interested, was that the veined marble in the fireplace, which is, you know, a pretty naturally occurring, as he describes it, metamorphic crystalline limestone, shares the characteristics of things like fingerprints, so no two pieces are the same. However, when they compared the marble filmed on the Titanic wreck with the marble of the fireplace in the corresponding stateroom aboard the Olympic, they were an exact match.
To take a opposing point of view, there is also some evidence that the Titanic, however, was not the Olympic. While the ships were very similar, they were in fact built side by side. I have before me some writing that indicates that the Titanic, unlike the Olympic, had an enclosed forward promenade, and you can still see that on the wreck today. Since the Olympic sailed for many years after the Titanic, also the Titanic had an identification number, which was 401. And since the wreck of the Titanic has been pretty well examined, you can find that number stamped. Well, not you, but this has been found on a couple of parts. Specifically here, the helm indicator and the propeller. And Harland and Wolff, which was the shipbuilder, stamped that identification number. And since you can still see that, that may indicate that it really is the Titanic there at the bottom of the ocean. There have been various other conspiracies regarding the Titanic. Certainly there were all kinds of people that had premonitions. We've talked about this before, that about the sinking, so perhaps there would be a conspiracy in there about some planning regarding that.
Well,
I don't know.
There's one other piece of information which is quite interesting. It says, before the ship, the Olympic, was broken up shortly before the Second World War, many of her fixtures and fittings were privately sold off, including the panelling from most of the public rooms. And the oak panelling from first-class smoking room is now installed in a conference room in a hotel, for example. It says other panelling from third-class areas of the ship now adorn a private apartment in the Wirral in the UK. And this woodwork has the reverse sides clearly marked. And on the panels, the number 400 is stenciled, which is the Olympic's number ID. But on the frames, the number 401, is clearly visible in this particular apartment.
So what do you think?
I think there was no iceberg.
Well, you know, the lookouts on the Titanic did not have binoculars, and this was definitely an impediment. Why didn't they have binoculars? Lookouts always have binoculars. If I haven't brought this up before, I certainly should sometime. The binoculars were found sometime later in a locker. But they didn't have them available. What kind of craziness is that? Perhaps there's a conspiracy there, too. And you can't see the icebergs? How do you know they're there?
And the telltale one for me is that, you know, in maritime convention, the crow's nest bell has the name and the number of the ship stamped upon it. And in this case, it was blank. So that proves it for me that it's all just a horrendous hoax. As
smoke
usual.
And mirrors.
Disgraceful.
Smoke and mirrors. All right, thank you very much, KMO. Neil Crater, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.